Hello and welcome to another episode of the Daily Remedy Podcast. Today we're here with Dr. Thomas Klein and Janelle Elgaway of the National Pain Council, a citizens group with no ties to any university, drug company, corporate entity, or government entity, operating solely as an independent entity to provide the facts and write papers in support for legislative changes over the opioid epidemic. Dr. Klein is the chief medical advisor, and Ms. Janelle Elgaway is executive director. And with that, I'd like to welcome both of them to the Daily Remedy Podcast.
Hello.
Glad to be here.
Let's begin high level and really let the audience understand who you guys are and what the National Pain Council is. So please begin by telling your stories and what led you to create the National Pain Council. I see that the mission statement reads, to provide equity in the treatment of all diseases for all patients. So please tell us your stories and how the organization began.
Janelle, go ahead.
Okay, well, Dr. Klein and I have been advocating since around 2017 16. And you know, that's when the 2016 CDC guidelines came out, and there was a push that patients either had to stay at a certain MME, morphine milligram equivalent, or go lower, or cut you off completely. So National Pain Council was actually, I don't know if Dr. Klein realizes this, but something I kind of had in my head, not the actual name, but just something I wanted to create with Dr. Klein at some point, because we started out by having, I created a podcast called, well, a network called Call360 Network. And at first it just was one podcast. And then I created the Doctor's Corner with Dr. Klein and I, and then two others. So we had four going at the same time. And I thought this would be a great way to get out information and educate the public. But, and then also inside, we would go to Washington, DC to meet with legislators, senators, and it just seemed like we were having issues. Like what we'd come have issues with is when we'd go to the legislators, they'd want to know what organization you were with. So, you know, and we didn't really have one. So that's when we kind of started to realize we needed to either be associated with one or create one. Then Dr. Klein, you know, was my doctor for a few years. And once he retired, that's kind of when we decided to put this together.
Oh, interesting. Dr. Klein?
Do you have anything to add?
Yeah, you know, General Mills, General Dynamics, General Electric. Well, I'm a general doctor. And in other words, I've had experience with neonatal intensive care, people 100 years old, people with developmental disabilities, people stuck at home when I did home care. I'm sort of a rehab medical person, sort of half a rehab physician and half an internist. So I've always been interested in long-term problems. I come from a family of engineers, not from a family of medical people. So my specialty is trying to figure out things that no one else can figure out. And I do that with my clinical experience of 45 years. But also I have a PhD that taught me how to do research. So we're backing up things. The National Pain Council is in the business of sharing information that we can back up. We don't make flat statements. Flat statements like opioids are harmful, that's a flat statement. We don't say things like that. We don't say things like opioids are wonderful, that's also a flat statement. We're in the business of, I think Janelle's saying in her group was the daily dose of truth. So we take questions from people and then we use that to do research and come up with papers that we are publishing currently at the National Pain Council to address the issues of what happened in the United States where nobody's being treated for pain. So that's what we do.
Certainly, it's now more than ever imperative to have an organized research base that addresses both the clinical and legislative aspects of the opioid epidemic and pain treatment. And I think that intersection is particularly interesting in recent years, as there seems to be this confluence, perhaps during the pandemic or probably preceding the pandemic, where social media, public health policy, and patient care have essentially blended into this murky intersection. You know, there's good things about it, there's bad things about it. What are your thoughts on this intersection? How has it worked positively for you guys and the National Pain Council? And in what ways has it created moral hazards in healthcare?
What's happened is we have an ancient fear of becoming addicted.
Right.
The most despicable caricature of a human being in the United States is a junkie. There's nothing worse than a junkie. Sex traffickers, murderers, arsonists don't even come close. And that's because there's a mixture of crime, moral turpitude, and, as the police say, a mope, N-O-P-E. That's an inside police term for a person who's not really a person.
Mm.
That's the view of most people. So nobody wants to end up being a junkie. So this has generated a fear of addiction, phobia. Now, phobia is a medical term. It means an irrational fear of something. There's real fears. You know, we live in a hurricane zone. I'm afraid of hurricanes. That's a rational fear. It is an irrational fear to be afraid of pain medicines that we've been using for almost 5,000 years. So fear is what we are going after with our facts and shows like this.
Well, thank you, Janelle. Do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, okay, so as a patient, no one can understand the enormous loss we suddenly deal with when many of us have been in a major, have major lifelong health issues. And so we're dealing with this. We have the constant pain. We're not able to work or make money or have a job. And we're unable to do most of the things that we loved and liked in life. And then on top of it now, we're concerned about, are we going to be able to get proper care and the medications that we need in order to have a quality of life? So, you know, we're struggling with all of that. And I feel like National Pain Council, another thing we do is we help patients. We set them up with doctors that are still accepting patients. And I've also created this thing where I call it doctor whispering, where I teach patients how to talk to a doctor. And I mean, because there's a way. I mean, you need to humanize yourself again, because a lot of them, they're just looking at the numbers. Okay, I have to get my patients all down to under 90 MMEs, or, you know, I'm going to have to drop some patients. And what I tell the patients is, you know, when you humanize them, remind them what life was like when you were having the proper pain care, and what life is like off of it now, and be very specific. And you know, it's not magic, but it works. And I mean, we've been able to help over 60 people within the last year be able to get their medications reinstated. And we found doctors for over 30 people. And the thing is it's like finding a needle in a haystack. Yeah. There's less and less doctors, and they're scared. You know, I understand it. Or some of them have drank the Kool-Aid and they think opioids are a terrible thing. You know, opioids have been around for, was it 3,000 years, Dr. Klein?
5,000.
5,000.
Yeah. 3,500 BC in Mesopotamia.
That's right. And, you know, they're natural anti-inflammatory. I mean, you know, people do not have a problem with addiction. You will know on that first pill, basically, if you're going to have addiction. Dr. Klein has a really good discussion about that, if you want to share, Dr. Klein.
Yeah, what we've discovered at the National Pain Council in doing some research and trying to view this with logic, Socrates invented logic 500 BC in Greece. And what it is, it's a method, a very mathematical method in huge books. It's a way to find the truth when you cannot do an experiment. So you can't do experiments with people in pain and say, well, you know, you don't get any pain medicine and we'll compare you to a group that does get pain medicine. You can't do stuff like that. So you use logic. So there's some simple things based on pieces of information. I asked five long-term pain management doctors with a total of 250 years of experience. I said, how many of your pain patients have become addicted to opiates? And they thought about it a minute, and they thought, and they thought, and guess what the answer was? None. None. So there's some genetic research coming out of Rockefeller Center, Research Center up in New York, all over the world, especially in Taiwan, at the big university there. What it appears is that opiate addiction is a little different than other addictions. You become addicted on the very first pill, which means if you have the genetic makeup to become a junkie, you're gonna know it immediately. Now you say, well, it's the same thing as if people that take methamphetamine, they're all gonna get high. That's true, but not everybody gets high on their first pain pill. As a matter of fact, only half of 1% get high on the first pain pill. So listen to the implications of this now. And remember, this is only opiate addiction. The other addictions are different. This means that if you do not become high on the very first pill or two, because that is what the addiction is. You've self-diagnosed your addiction. If you go to the doctor for the very first time in your life and get an opiate for the very first time and you get high, you've just diagnosed yourself as having opiate addiction disease. But 99.5% of people, so that means if you got 1,000 people lined up in a stadium, and you go around and you give them all bags of opiate medicines and heroin even, 995 will never addict to opiates. Never. I went to my dentist and we were talking about it. And I said, so here's the question. It's called ask the critical question to his patients. Have you ever had an opiate pain medicine? Yes. Did you become addicted to it and fly to the moon? No. Then you never will become addicted. And if you do become addicted, if you're one of those four people per thousand, and it runs in families, and there's going to be genetic tests soon, then you know immediately what's going on. And so you go to an addiction doctor or a good family doctor, and you say, okay, I got this disease now. What am I going to do? Well, you got to do some things like not go on your own and take more opiates, because the experience that people with this genetic abnormality experience by taking an opiate is so unbelievably wonderful that people cannot understand or even come close to understanding it. So during that very first stage, let's say you're one of the half of 1% that has the disease. You've just diagnosed it. Uh-oh, I've just gone to the moon. So I got to stop taking this stuff immediately and let my doctor know. Then you can control the disease. There does not ever need to be another death from opiate addiction.
Wow, that's very interesting data. And I think information that needs to be disseminated more widely in the public. I want to circle back on a few points you guys made because I think they're very important. Janelle, you used the phrase humanize the patient. Well, Dr. Klein, earlier you had talked about an irrational phobia, but what you just articulated was very logical and coherent set of data that's now being studied at some of the most prestigious institutions in the United States. Why does phobia persist? Why does irrationality and dehumanization persist despite the available data, the logic, to phrase it as you did? Why are we not able to reconcile the logic to overcome the irrational phobias?
Too afraid. If you're afraid of something, you're not going to listen to any logic. Fear governs everything. And it's like President Roosevelt said, the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. In other words, the fear itself takes over. So if a person is afraid, then no matter what you say to them, they're not going to be listening. So what we're trying to do at the National Pain Council is very slowly use the daily dose of truth. In other words, a little at a time, and then challenge it. You know, that's what the Socratic logical method is to challenge. So what I've said, I expect it to be challenged. And then we get into a logical argument and we use rules of logic. And we don't use fallacies like saying, my uncle was addicted once. That's not what you do in logic. And they say, well, Dr. Klein, how do you know this about the addiction on the first pill? We asked 50 heroin addicts, and we have a doctor in Boston, and we have an actress by the name of Jamie Lee Curtis. And they'll all tell you it was the very first time they had an opiate ever in their life. And they went to the moon on the very first pill. Interestingly, both the actress and the doctor maintained their addiction with Vicodin. So not everybody goes to heroin. The only reason people go to heroin is for cost. If they could get their hands on prescription medicines, they would much rather have that. And that's what medicated assisted treatment is. But we're not going to get into that yet because people are so afraid. They're not going to be listening to you giving dope. The dopers? Are you crazy? So we got to take it one step at a time. So right now we're looking at facts, and it's the fear that overrides things. You cannot logic with somebody when they're afraid.
Certainly. Janelle, you're about to say something?
Yeah. Okay. So back in the 80s and 90s, we had the AIDS epidemic, and I was in junior high then. And you know, at the time, I thought what was put out, you know, by the media, I mean, there's these myths and it's the fear that drives it too. But, you know, if I kiss somebody on the cheek, I would get AIDS. You know what I mean? If you touch somebody, you could get AIDS. Like, these were all the myths that were out kind of going around. And what they did in our schools is we had a program called Peer Helpers. And so a professional would come in and teach the peer helpers. And that was probably, I don't know, a group of 30 kids. And we would learn, you know, safe sex. We would learn the actual facts about AIDS. And then what we would do is go and to classes throughout our whole school district and teach the kids that. So it'd be kids teaching kids. It really was helpful. You know, and then we could go home and tell our parents this stuff too, because they didn't always have that. So I would, at National Pain Council, what we are putting together is we are going to do a similar thing. We have to create the education first. And then what we'd like to do is be able to go into schools and teach, because education is so pertinent in all of this. The public, the media, even legislators, everybody, you know, has a certain view about things. And a lot of this has been driven, and public perception has been driven by people like Dr. Andrew Kolodny or Dr. Roger Chow from PROP, or Physicians Responsible Opioid Prescribing, who was really kind of behind helping the CDC create these guidelines. But like Dr. Andrew Kolodny has stated to when he's interviewed that, these are heroin pills. Pain medicine is heroin pills. So stuff like that is really pointed, and it puts a negative stigma on all of this stuff. So, and that's part of the fear then too. So I think between education, legislation, and litigation is how we're going to be able to fix a lot of these things, because, you know, behind the CDC guidelines, then states, I think, was it 33 states, 37 states, they went in and put actual laws into their states of what, how doctors should prescribe. So now it's not even, you know, a federal thing or a blanket statement or, you know, of a guideline. There's actually laws in certain states. So now you have to go in and get a law to protect the patients and the doctors. And one of the things I come up against is palliative care.
Yeah.
You know, the first sentence of the CDC guidelines, it says palliative care patients are exempt, cancer patients, you know, and end of life. And you would think that somebody that is dealing with maybe a cancer that they're not going to die from, but they have, you know, they're disabled afterwards, or people that are disabled that have diseases like CRPS or complex regional pain syndrome or adhesive arachnoiditis or Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. These are things that are very debilitating, and you know, you have no quality of life. And, you know, with pain medications and, you know, other therapies that they can do in a combination of medications, people are actually allowed to, able to get their quality of life back. They're able to kind of, you know, be able to take care of their families. And if you push palliative care, now that you come up against is like, well, doctors will say, oh, well, you're just trying to get more medications.
Yeah.
And it's a negative thing, but yeah, you are trying to get medications, but it's not like, you know, there's an addiction issue here, you know, or an opioid use disorder that they've thrown out too now. So go ahead. So I think through education, it's slowly how we'll change things. You know, we have to be able to get out into the media and start having comments of not the myths so much or the pointed stuff to push the stigma, but more of the truths, you know?
Yeah. Let's contextualize this notion of fear and irrationality into the modern context of the opioid epidemic. There is a clear disconnect between law enforcement and health policy experts at the federal, state, and local level, as you alluded to, Janelle. It seems like actions that would otherwise be regulatory or settled as civil matters quickly become criminal matters, quickly become legal matters that go straight to the highest courts in the land. Why is the fear creating such a gap between the medical and legal world?
Remember the old movies in the 1950s when people came from outer space and they scared people? What's the first thing they did? Who'd they call?
I don't know.
They called the army. So when people are frightened, what do? They call the police.
Yeah.
When people are really frightened, what they do is they set up a federal drug police. We're the only country that we found in our research that has a federal drug police.
Wow.
Most other countries, it's part of the, you know, national police force or local police force. We're the only ones. We're the only country that we know of where if I get a license to practice medicine, I cannot prescribe pain medicines without getting a DEA license. I pay $750 every 2 years to get a DEA license with no benefits, except they can come and arrest me. The law was created out of fear. Interestingly, Richard Nixon created this law to capture his political enemies because he was afraid of them. It wasn't really a drug issue. It was an issue that if you didn't like the Black Panthers, you go raid them and look for a little bit of cocaine. If you find a bag of cocaine, you can arrest the entire group. But you can't go and arrest the entire group because you don't like their politics. Yeah. Marijuana was considered a drug as bad as heroin. It's called a class one drug. And who smoked? Oh, it was only hippies and left-wingers. So Richard Nixon got together with John Mitchell and they created this horrible law called the Controlled Substance Act specifically for a political purpose. And John Ehrlichman came clean 20 years later and has told us that was true. So even that was based on fear. why don't we get rid of a police force that runs around putting doctors in prison? Fear. It's fear that the doctors are handing out medicine that's going to turn you into a junkie.
Yeah.
Well, and then also, all you have to do is this, you know, the federal drug police or state medical boards, you take, you know, you put a few doctors in jail, you take their license, and suddenly everybody is fearful of prescribing, you know, of the doctors. So I understand that.
What we're after is slowly telling the truth.
Yeah.
So you see, here's the way a Socratic argument would go. You'd sit down with a police officer and you from the federal drug police, the DEA, and say, okay, tell me what you're trying to do. And they say, well, and we've heard this from DEA supervisors, we are protecting you from addiction. We are protecting you from the immorality of addiction. That's even in the DEA regulations about morality. It's in the Controlled Substance Act, 1970. It's in there about being immoral. So you see, not only do we have something that's an addiction, which is no fun to have, but now it's immoral. I mean, what could be worse? An immoral criminal. So the truth of the matter is, these are real diseases. Opiate addiction, junkies, heroin addicts have a real live brain disease that we can see on special MRIs called PET scans, which we can see with blood tests for the genes. It's a real disease. Now, other cocaine and methamphetamine use are also addictions, but they're not hardcore addictions. And we don't have any legislation or meetings or podcasts about methamphetamine. We probably should. It's a lot worse than addiction. But no, we're still focused on these opioids because the fear started in 1900. And the fear was based on sex and immorality. It was white women were having their virtues stolen from them by Chinese opium den owners. And remember, 1900, women were still wearing long black dresses and were still put on pedestals by the male society and not allowed to go to high school, not allowed to have jobs. They were put on pedestals. So it was the man's job to protect the virtue of the women. And here's a drug that ruined their virtue. And that's how it got started. And unfortunately, it's not true because opiate addiction's got nothing to do with morality. People don't make bad choices. They become addicted accidentally, not knowing. You know, what are all these stories about kids going to doctors and getting a prescription and suddenly becoming heroin addicts? That's accidental addiction. In other words, it's triggering the genetic response, different than going off and getting methamphetamine and injecting it or smoking it for 2 weeks and then, you know, getting more and more addicted. I mean, that's a learned type of addiction. Opiate addiction, the one we focus on, is not learned and it's not immoral.
I want to now transition and talk about effective advocacy, what it means and does not mean for both you individually and for the National Pain Council. Janelle, I know that you are both a patient and an advocate, so there's a lot of personal experience in the work that you do. Can you talk about effective advocacy while also sharing your own personal story?
Yeah, sure. And, you know, a lot of the stuff that we're creating with National Pain Council, a lot of it is from things that I've learned. I've been dealing with my health issues for over 30 years now. You know, I originally had a car accident when I was 16 years old. And I was stopped making a left-hand turn and a pickup truck hit me going 55 miles an hour. And I was dead on site, life flighted to the hospital, and I broke my C3, C4 vertebrae. the week after I was supposed to play in the Junior Olympics for field hockey. So yeah. I was in great shape, you know. I did come back from that accident. I was a year out of sports and stuff like that, but then I came back and I actually went on to play at the Ohio State University. I had a scholarship there. And then I also played on the United States field hockey team. And I got on the B squad for the 1996 Olympics. So my health issues didn't really affect me yet, but after college in 2003, I was in another car accident. I was in a passenger and I broke my C4, C5 vertebrae. And like when I woke up in the hospital, I was in shock and they released me, but it was a Friday evening, Saturday morning, I woke up and my like entire left arm and hand was completely limp. It was like, it was a phantom arm almost, like, you know, it didn't move or anything. I was paralyzed. And, you know, Monday I went to my primary care and he's like, sweetheart, you need to see a neurosurgeon, which they should have probably sent me immediately. But Wednesday I went in and within 30 minutes, they had me in emergency surgery. So that was kind of like the accident that kind of really started where I became disabled. Within a few years, I became permanently disabled. I did get my arm back after 2.5 years of physical therapy, but then I developed fibromyalgia and then they did a fusion. I went on to get five neck surgeries total. So I'm fused from my C3 to C7. But then I started to develop these incurable, painful diseases like complex regional pain syndrome, fibromyalgia, Raynaud's disease. Now I have seizures. And it seems like once you get one, you continue to get more. And the crazy part is I was in my 20s. This is in early 2000s. And there was nothing online. You don't have a playbook for anything when your life is immediately changed like that. Like you just don't understand the gravity of what is going to happen next. You don't, you know, you go to a doctor and they tell you to go on these medicines and to do all these therapies and you just do it, you know, and you trust it. But I learned after several years, sometimes less is more, you know, yeah. Like I didn't like being like that. So, and over time I had to learn how to talk to my doctor. I mean, I used to think at one point, you know, when you go to the doctor, you should look how you feel. And now, especially with the fear of addiction and everything like that, that's the furthest thing you want to do. So, you know, like when I talk with people and, you know, this is stuff that I've just learned over the years and I'm just putting that into this now and sharing with others. But, you know, I just let them know, you know, always go in, you know, like looking not disheveled or anything like that, but looking, you know, put together. And, you know, and there's a certain way to talk. You want to stay away from using words like pain because now that's kind of like a trigger word for everything. But advocacy to me and with National Pain Council is, you know, again, we want to provide tools for each individual patient so they can have those tools going forward on how to advocate for themselves. But then also we want to work with affiliates that we have. I think we have up to like 30 affiliates right now and other organizations that we, you know, we know people within because we also have to use facts and education to create state laws to protect patients and doctors. And also we have to fix the doctor-patient relationship. I mean, I don't even know if that's really there anymore. There's no trust amongst the patient and doctors now, yeah. I think, which is it's terrible. Because when you go to your doc, I always, like doctors always were kind of on a pedestal to me, you know, and I always respected them and, you know, listened to them and trusted them. And now it's not always like that. I mean, you could go in as a patient and they're trying to take away the one thing that seems to kind of help and give you a quality of life again. We found at National Pain Council that, you know, there's around 10 million patients that are currently being cut off completely of their medications or lower to a level that really just doesn't even work for them. So, you know, we need to help these people and through advocating, that's how we're going to do it, you know, and again, education, sorry.
And Dr. Klein.
Harvard, when you joined the Harvard Medical School family, they make it real clear to you that each person that works, their nurse or technician or doctor, has three jobs. One, education. You teach others. And so for doctors, that means teaching medical students. Two, you see patients. In other words, you actually get your hands dirty. And three, you do research. So if you're on the faculty, especially as a physician or a senior nurse, you're expected to do all three. So that's what we do at the National Pain Council. Janelle just talked about helping patients. So we're just, quote, seeing patients. We are doing educational stuff, which includes legislation, educating legislators to make new laws to try to deal with this fear of addiction phobia. Yeah. There is addiction, but not nearly to the degree that most people believe, and not to the degree that it can be treated. We have a death rate of 100,000 people in the United States from overdose deaths. First of all, that's inflated by the CDC by half. There's really 50,000, and they admitted it, and they don't seem to correct it. So keep it at 100,000 in several countries in Europe where they are treating people with heroin disease with proper medications. The death rate dropped 80%. Mm. So that means we could potentially drop our death rate from 100,000 to 20,000. But you know what? I don't think people really want to do that, because we are governed by fear of addiction. And people think that because there's more overdose deaths, there's also more addiction to opiates. That's not true. It is true we have more overdose deaths. They've been increasing every year since 1970. But the number of addicts has not increased in the United States per population base since 1920 and all the years in between. The worldwide addiction rate to heroin is the same, which is 0.5% that's in the United States. So it's the fear that's really driving things. And that's what we're trying to get at and to give true facts.
Yeah. So much has come out in recent years in terms of data, studies that you've cited, and patients now advocating for themselves and advocating for others, which hopefully should make some strides in debunking these erroneous narratives that seem to perpetuate. How can we effectively address these false narratives? Do we go the social media route? Do we try to reach out to traditional media outlets? Do we go to the politicians directly? And if that's the route, is it a patient or a physician that makes the change? Can you talk a little bit about how to raise awareness and then transition awareness into effective change?
Well, you know, I mean, a lot of this is, you know, a grassroots, it's creating a grassroots movement, kind of. And by, you know, working together, I mean, this is what's hard. So you have patients that, you know, this is happening to patients, and nobody was ready for this. And, you know, we don't have a lot of money, you know, we don't have a lot of power and you know, ability to get out there is always to the media. So, you know, this grassroots movement that we've all, put together with and are starting to work together, it's kind of building up more and more. And so, yeah, we're having to actually be the one that's educating people now. And yes, we could go to the media, you know, we could go to the legislators. A project that we're going to do at National Pain Council is we are going to take comments, you know, for example, through like what Dr. Kalania said, or the studies that they used within the CDC guidelines to create their guidelines. And if you kind of go through them, we're going to take like each comment and show what they say, and then we're going to, you know, actually look it up. And, wow. And that's what I'm so surprised at. The media, they have not followed up with some of the things that are being put out there. And I'm just shocked. I mean, that's their job. That's, if you start looking and researching a little bit, you will see actually that not everything is true in it, you know? So that's definitely like, you know, a way that we can do this and fight this.
Yeah, Janelle, you make a very interesting point, because what few realize is that there are literally so few who are perpetuating these false narratives and reiterating these mistruths, for lack of a better word, yet it continues to perpetuate. Dr. Klein, in your estimates, what are the lever points of change? What will it take for all of this to go from an awareness campaign to a campaign of change?
Well, you need to do a systems analysis to figure out what the problem is. And the problem is fear of addiction, phobia. So first we need to deal with that. Until we deal with that, nothing's going to happen. And we need to understand that there's actually two categories of addiction. And we need a few other facts. But how do people change their minds when they have it woven into their fabric that junkies are immoral criminals? What's the natural process when a person is now curious about the myths? Some people say, hey, this is true. So those people you don't bother with. But if somebody says, you know, I really believe that junkies are immoral criminals, but, and then asks a question, then you're on the road to finding the truth. And that's what the Socratic method is that Socrates taught us. If there's an inconsistency, you start to ask questions and you keep asking questions. This is what investigative reporters do. They keep asking questions. For example, there's 100,000 people that have died from drug overdoses. Well, what's the next question? Who are they? 95% of people of the 100,000 are people in the heroin community, not in neighborhoods. So you see, nobody's ever asked the basic question, who are they? What drugs are you talking about? They always present the total drug overdoses, and then they say, oh, 60% of those are opioid related.
Yeah.
Related. So if you're taking 16 different drugs, and one of them is an opiate, and you die, you have an opiate-related death.
Yeah. Dr. Klein, I want to touch on this point because you had mentioned it a few times, and I think that it's very important to break into more nuanced terms. And that's the notion of fear and the irrationality that fear produces. You have stated logic combats fear. And when we talk about the opiate epidemic and all the various figures in this epidemic, it's easy to assume the worst in others when they take a position you may not agree with or have a viewpoint that may differ from yours. A lot of times the logic is thrown out the window, and it seems to be a culture-wide phenomenon. How can we fight fear when we've, quite frankly, done such a poor job in fighting fear in so many other arenas of life?
You start with the group of people where 90% of heroin addiction starts. Teenagers. Teenagers are the ones who become addicted. People say, oh, teenagers' brains aren't fully developed. Every teenager I met, their brains are fine. I don't know how that ever got started. But what is it about teenagers? What is it about young people that has to do with addiction? We just learned that addiction starts when the first pill in your life. So how many teenagers have had previous exposure to opiates? Not very many. 90% of addiction starts in teenage years. How many conferences, articles, and summits have you heard of that's asking the question, what about all these teenagers? What's going on? I have New York Times articles from the 1950s that I use to compare with what's going on now, and they sound exactly the same. But you know, in 1950 in New York City, where they were talking about heroin addiction, they were concerned about teenagers. We aren't. That's odd. So I think teenagers are the place to start, because teenagers have very well-developed brains, and they're great at listening to new ideas, and they're great thinkers. So if we teach teenagers that the way addiction starts is on your first opiate pill, and they go to a party, and by the way, Americans are the world's heaviest use of users of illicit drugs. We're number one. So you're not going to ever stop that. So you go to a party, and they've got whatever's available. Drug dealers have whatever's available. So I ask teenagers around here, what's going on? And it changes. Well, oxycodone was popular for a while, and that's gone. But let's say there's oxycodone is, hey, pal, you want to try this? So the kid takes an oxycodone tablet and goes, oh my God, this is so wonderful, I can't believe it. He just diagnosed a case of opiate addiction, because you don't get euphoric if you don't have the genetic setup. So I asked my teenage friend, I said, would you tell them that they probably are addicted or going to become addicted next week? No, typical teenagers, you know. But if teenagers know this, then they can teach the doctors to ask the question, have you ever had an opiate? And if the answer is no, then you say, okay, here's the deal. One out of 300 of you has got one of these funny genes. And you're going to know it, because on the very first pill, you're going to go to the moon. As a matter of fact, I've got some Vicodin here. Your prescription is ready. I want you to take one and go sit out in the waiting room. And then I want you to come back in 30 minutes and tell me how you're feeling. 99 out of 100 people will say, I feel sick. I feel a little relaxed. The pain is better. But nobody will say, I've just gone to the moon. Right in the office. So if you teach teenagers, then they could teach the doctors, who are the last people to learn new things. And the teenagers can teach their parents. So, hey, mom, have you ever had an opiate? No, I actually haven't. Okay, next time you're in an emergency room, that should be the question the doctors ask, and they never ask it. The most important family history question is, do you have a family history of addiction and alcoholism? And it's very, very strong.
And Dr. Khan, let's play that out, because I think this is a very important point for people to understand. Giving patients an environment in which they can express their experiences with medications is extremely important and destigmatizing. Those who may not, sadly, have experienced the benefits of a destigmatized patient encounter may easily think, well, why would patients be honest? Why wouldn't a patient just say it's relieving the pain and openly acknowledge that, yes, I'm feeling certain sensations of euphoria, perhaps I have a higher than normal risk of dependency and addiction. In your experiences, can you talk about how trust begets trust, and destigmatizing experiences with medications can foster honest conversation?
Well, we go back to the teenagers. I think it would be very nice if teenagers sat down and had conversations with people who are on heroin. Because the teenagers need to know, how'd you get into this fix? Gee whiz, you're like a regular person. The funny thing about opiate addiction is that it hits anybody.
Yeah.
Dr. Grinspoon, who wrote a book on it at Mass General in Boston, Jamie Lee Curtis. There are tons and tons of people
who became addicted, and they were not running around looking to get high. They were just either getting a doctor's prescription or they were messing around. And so the destigmatizing has to come from face to face. Martin Luther King said that hatred comes from separation. You know, you cannot separate people. In the Truth and Reconciliation in South Africa, after Mandela took over as president, they all sat around a big table. The police on one side that shot and killed somebody's relative, and the relatives sitting there around this big table saying, "What happened? I was afraid," the police officer says. "I was afraid I would die. So I lost control." And then the family would say, "Well, you know, I understand that because it was at a standoff and everybody's being hostile." So you see that kind of destigmatizing people. We definitely need to destigmatize people who are on pain. They are just considered lowly. I think a lot of people would be surprised if they met patients who have these long-term painful disorders like Janelle, that they, gee whiz, they appear to be normal. They're not. And you know, the press really does a bad job. You read articles in the paper about somebody in pain and they always look awful.
Yep.
Always. They never, ever look like a normal person. The 10 million people in the United States that have these god-awful persistent pain disorders are all just regular people, you know? They're not in sleeveless undershirts driving pickup trucks, although I do have a pickup truck, you know? And so we need to destigmatize chronic pain. There was a great movie, HBO, just cut me off if I go on and on, by Lynn Webster, and it was called The Painful Truth. But the problem was all the people interviewed, nobody actually gave their diagnoses. Mm. These painful diseases have diagnoses. Chronic, complex regional pain disease, interstitial cystitis, trigeminal neuralgia, adhesive arachnoiditis. And we have now a publication at the National Pain Council, which kind of starts to list these diseases. Nobody's ever put them into a list. Yeah. Matter of fact, it's not recognized. So we got to destigmatize pain patients.
Janelle, can you talk from your own personal experience, what it was like to have honest conversations with your physician and at times where you felt like you could not be honest with them?
Well, yeah, I mean, honestly, the last 5 to 10 years, as a patient, you are scared to talk to your doctor and be honest. And I will tell patients, and I do it myself, I only put out, I'm very short and sweet when I'm at my doctor's office. I don't put out more than I need to say. Sometimes I won't share everything just because I know that there's certain words that, you know, they'll pick up on and focus on that instead of, you know, what's going on. For example, I had to go to a neurologist the other day for my seizures. And I put that off for 2 years because I was scared to death that if I went in there, he would look at the medication I'm on and be like, oh, you know, and just try to get in between that, even though he was not my doctor for that, or he would only focus on that instead of what my actual issue is and what can I do? So, you know, even in there, I mean, I was very pointed on what I said. He did bring up, oh, well, you're on a lot of medication, because I said my memory is bad. And I'm like, I've been on these medications for over 19 years. And, you know, it only got like this once the seizure started. So, you know, he backed off pretty quickly. The thing that is important to, I kind of think of it as like an army of, you know, of truth setters, you know, I'm putting out there, like, I mean, the patients that we teach and stuff like that, when they go into their doctor, I'll do like a role play with them of what that doctor would basically say and how they can back up what they say then. Like, you know, it's almost like manipulating the conversation to the way that you want to go. We also tell people to take in articles, you know, that have specific stats for them, that, you know, how they can back up what they're saying. And I'm really surprised, because you would think doctors would know the facts and the information. I don't know if it's the fear that has changed that, or if they, I'm not sure why they're just going along with this.
Yeah,
it's fear.
It's tough.
It's fear of addiction phobia. You see, that's what's behind all this.
Yeah.
As a physician, I tended to be very conservative with treating people with opiates before the last 6 years when I got involved with this. I remember I saw a lady at home, she was in her 90s, and she took a Vicodin in the morning and a Vicodin in the evening, and that way she could work in her garden and function. But I tried to talk her out of it. Why? See, we grow up with these prejudices as doctors that these are bad drugs. So we need to understand that this is probably the most wonderful drug ever. And it comes from a plant. And you can take it your entire life and not have any side effects. The drug has almost no side effects. Now, people jump all over me. They say, whoa, what about addiction? Addiction is not a side effect. The addiction is what's called an adverse drug response. That means there's something in the person that's causing the problem. If it's in the drug, then it's a side effect, like constipation and things like that with opiate pain medicine. But you can take Tylenol and die from a rare skin disease called Stevens-Johnson syndrome.
Yeah.
It's a black box warning at FDA. But that is an ADR. That's an adverse drug response. That is not a side effect of the drug. So there's a very important difference.
What people don't realize either is, I mean, patients, when they are going to probably be on some level of pain medication the rest of their lives, they have tried probably everything. You know, I mean, they had to get shots, surgeries, different medications and combinations. And like, I remember for me, when my doctor said, you know, Janelle, this is the best you're going to get, you know, you have to do what you can do, you know, to have a quality of life. And that's when he said, you know, why don't you try a pain medication? I was scared to death because I thought I'd become an addict or something, you know, and just because I didn't know any different. And a lot of people are that way. That's how the majority of the patients are, you know, going into this. So it's not something that we wanted to do, but it's a way that we can have a life again. And it's funny because a lot of people, they won't realize that I'm even on medications, you know, and when I tell them, they're like, oh my gosh, like, you know, they're surprised because I guess they expect me to kind of be out of it, you know, not track and look different, kind of like a, you know, a drug addict, I guess.
Yeah, it's amazing the prejudices that pervade pain and the treatment of it, as Dr. Klein had mentioned. What I'd like to do now in the remaining minutes that we have is to really get a sense of what's next for National Pain Council and what people can expect from you guys and how people can get involved.
Okay, so our website is nationalpaincouncil.org. And when you go in, you can just sign up. There's no membership fees. We always are accepting volunteers. The majority of our volunteers are patients that have incurable diseases that have, you know, been affected because of the opioid crisis that is going on, and having issues being able to either find doctors or being able to get the medications that they've been on for so long. So, and we set it up, you know, a certain way that you could do all of this if you have a phone and the internet, you know, how we volunteer and advocate within this. What else?
some of the projects that we are working on. We want to introduce state legislation to stop this nonsense at the prescription drug counter, where the pharmacist says, "I don't feel comfortable." We're going to get some states to introduce what's called a no-fill bill, so that if you don't want to fill a prescription as a pharmacist, which is the pharmacist's prerogative, but you've got to call up the doctor, and the two of you will fill out a one-page form about why not. And that form will go to the state pharmacy board. So no more of this, "Oh, I don't feel like doing it." So that's a piece of legislation. We definitely want the harmful CDC guidelines revoked. We don't need more guidelines. We've got plenty. The federal government is not in the business of writing medical manuals, which this is. So that's a big project. We want it gone. It's being used to jail doctors. Dr. Stephen Henson, who I know, was not selling any medicine, which is the drug trafficking law that doctors are tried under. And he's in prison for the rest of his life.
Wow.
Okay. Joel Smithers, 5 children, 40 years old, did not sell any medications. His patients did, but he's in prison for 40 years. So these are our projects. We're counting on the Supreme Court to help us out with this Ruan decision. We are definitely interested in interfacing with teenagers and getting some education going. There will be huge resistance to it, so we're going to make it private. People can get their own education on YouTube, you know, so we're going to pursue that. We need to get the truth out that you do not need to be frightened about taking pain medicine, because the FDA only has one medicine approved for severe pain. And that are opiates. If you don't want to take an opiate, you're going to have to just suffer with severe pain, period. There's nothing else that works. So pain medicines are not kryptonite. They are not the evil empire. The CDC says that they don't work and they cause addiction. The CDC needs to go before Congress and tell them what they're doing practicing medicine, because the CDC doesn't even have regulatory authority. Their job is to track infectious disease. This has gone way, way off the rails. And Congress needs to look into an agency that is indirectly regulating and causing harm every single day. We estimate 3,000 people a day are being taken off long-term medications that they absolutely need, like Jonelle Eljoy, who's here.
Yeah, certainly.
To add to that too, we need to also network and with like large publications and stuff like that with media, we need to start being able to comment within those. So, you know, say if they have something on, say if they interview some like Dr. Andrew Kalodny or something, and he makes a comment because he's an anti-opioid zealot, we need to be able to have our comments in there too. You know, so we have to start working our way within that. And we're doing that through contacts, you know, and meeting people. And it's the same way with legislators. We need to start getting them to know who we are so we could start sharing the truth.
Yeah.
You know, and breaking down those stigmas that are currently there.
No, perfect. And I think that it's such an important job that you two are doing. And I would encourage everybody who's made it this far into the podcast to go on your computers or smartphones and look up National Pain Council and get involved. And with that, I'd like to thank Jonelle and Dr. Klein for your time. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.